Chapter 67. Stick-up men. If you want to understand the hidden mystique of firearms, take a heavy revolver, a toy will do, and heft it in the palm of your hand. It produces an undoubted feeling of satisfaction, of power. You find yourself automatically holding it at arm's length, closing one eye, and pulling the trigger. The naturalist Raymond Dart suggested that man achieved his present position on the evolutionary scale by his use of weapons, because about 750,000 years ago, one of our remote ancestors discovered that the shoulder bone of an antelope could be used to smash the skull of a hyena before he was within range of its teeth. This is certainly plausible, but it still fails to explain the peculiar, potent attraction of guns. On the other hand, if Dart is correct, another interesting hypothesis suggests itself. The gun is a kind of magic weapon. You point it at an enemy, even someone twice your size, and he stops in his tracks. It's like a wizard's wand. Now, man has always been the weakling of the animal family, less powerful than the ape, less agile than the monkey, less swift than almost any four-footed animal, and without the claws and canines that protect the carnivores. Science has never discovered how man survived the great droughts of the Pleistocene Age, when he had to compete with all the other animals for the water holes. And even when he achieved civilization, he remained perpetually in danger from his own kind. Marauding tribesmen might sweep down on his village and undo the work of a lifetime in half an hour. Or his cities might be burned to the ground by pirates. Surely one of the deepest cravings of human nature is to be invulnerable, to be able to strike down an enemy by merely pointing at him. The gun satisfies this need. And this is why it has such a strange appeal, even to the most peaceable and kindly of men. All of which helps to explain the otherwise inexplicable fact that, while we all feel the strongest disapproval of burglars, footpads, and pickpockets, we have a distinct tendency to make heroes out of equally antisocial thugs like Dick Turpin, Jesse James, and John Dillinger. The stick-up men. We don't actually approve of them, yet because they hold the magic wand of sudden death, we endow them with a legendary charisma. Nevertheless, there are good grounds for arguing that the stick-up man is no more than a burglar with a psychological problem. A man who commits robbery by pointing a gun at his victim is doubling or trebling his risk of being caught. As a burglar, he stands a chance of entering a house unseen and unheard, and even if he's forced to flee, his chances of being recognised are minimal. The stick-up man, on the other hand, may wear a mask, but his victim can still distinguish the shape of his face, note his build and his height, and memorise his voice. It's true that if he's robbing a bank, his profits may be many times greater than the burglars, but the great majority of stick-up men rob petrol stations and shops, and their takings may be less than a week's wages obtained by honest work. In fact, he seems to find his way of stealing money altogether more satisfying than burglary. It involves a confrontation with another human being, perhaps several, pointing a gun, giving orders, and being obeyed. It's an ego-boosting exercise, and it produces some of the primitive satisfaction that wild tribesmen experience when they defeat their enemies in battle. There are many burglars who express their aggression by slashing carpets and furniture in the apartments they enter, sometimes even urinating or excreting on the floor. Psychologically speaking, such a man is midway between the ordinary, non-aggressive burglar and the stick-up man. He also has a desire to assert himself in the face of a society that considers him a nobody, but the aggression is not quite powerful or constant enough to lead him to wave a gun at a bank clerk. He's closer in type to certain sex offenders, who may be mild and inoffensive most of the time, until they feel a sudden compulsion to expose themselves to a child or to steal underwear from a clothesline. But the aggression, the need to express dominance, is only the factor that leads the stick-up man to choose his particular brand of antisocial activity in the first place. He may be compelled to continue because of another factor that criminals are inclined to forget, the problems of a man on the run. The film Bonnie and Clyde made this admirably clear. For the young stick-up man, life begins as an adventure. He strolls into stores, strolls out with a handful of dollars, and drives off with one arm around his girlfriend. But a year or so later, he's sick of sleeping with a gun under his pillow, of looking out for police ambushes, unable to visit old friends or relatives for more than a few hours. His natural aggression is sharpened by a certain desperation and bitterness, and unconsciously he may long to be caught. Finally, the desperation may drive him to a kind of suicidal madness, and innocent lives may be endangered. The career of Frank Dick may be cited as a textbook example of this desperation syndrome. Born in Galveston, in Texas, Dick first ran foul of the law in 1949, shortly after his discharge from the US Navy. He was caught trying to rob a chicken coop and received a few months in jail. Dick was not a brilliant criminal. In fact, he was a bungler who was held in low esteem in the Galveston underworld, and lack of success in his ventures turned him mean. Captain John Cleverhagen, who arrested Dick on several occasions, is quoted as saying, "He isn't smart enough to be a good lunchbox burglar, but he'll damn sure hurt you if he gets the chance." In 1955, a store owner intercepted him as he was making off with the proceeds of a burglary. Dick beat him up. He was caught, and this time it looked as if he faced a long sentence. On the way to court, Dick attacked the man who was escorting him and escaped. It was then that he decided to become a stick-up man. He held up the madam of a brothel, which he occasionally frequented. When a policeman tried to arrest him a week later, he hit him in the stomach with both hands, held out as if to accept the handcuffs, and ran away. A few days later, police recognised him as he was about to enter another brothel with felonious intent. Again, he escaped, this time with a bullet in his leg. At this point, Dick obviously felt that a return to a safer mode of crime was indicated. He moved to Kansas City, Missouri, and he went back to burglary. Here, he was caught burgling a lighted store and sent to prison for a year. The Texas authorities indicated that they would like to interview him, but when Dick was released from jail in 1957, no one tried to stop him from walking away. With a stupidity that seems typical, he returned to Texas and was arrested in Houston. Someone put up his bail, but he vanished again. Rearrested in Lansing, Kansas, he was returned to Texas and sentenced to prison. He was sent to an open prison at Ferguson and walked out. Rearrested by Cleverhagen, he was sent to an escape-proof prison, and he remained there until 1969, when he was released on parole. Suspecting that he was still wanted in Kansas, he broke parole and went into hiding, staying with his wife. But his wife was sick of having a husband who was always on the run, and she threw him out. Dick decided to go back to crime. He reasoned that it was time he pulled a big job that would enable him to retire to South America. But this seemed the only way to escape the vicious circle in which he was trapped. Diamonds, he decided, were the answer. He began to case jewellers in Houston, and his choice fell on Wolfson's, a small, exclusive jeweller whose stones were all of high quality. In the guise of a businessman, wearing expensive clothes, he called at the store and paid $500 on a diamond ring. He regarded the money as an investment, for in his half-dozen visits to the shop, he had noted the position of the alarms, the number of employees, and where the safe was kept. He had obtained the money for the clothes and for the deposit from smaller hold-ups. In September 1969, he decided he needed more preparation for the big job, so he robbed a supermarket of $6,000. The manager ran out after him, shooting, and Dick was hit in the shoulder. The bullet was still there on November the 11th when he walked into Wolfson's with a large sack. From the beginning, the robbery was a failure. Dick pulled a gun, ordered the store owner, his wife, and a salesman into the back room, and shackled them with leg irons from the sack. And then he made Aaron Wolfson open the safe, filled his sack, and went around the display cases, removing the jewellery. At this moment, a man about to enter the store noticed Dick with the gun. He closed the door quietly and gave the alarm to an unarmed policewoman outside. Within minutes, several police cars were on their way to Wolfson's. Meanwhile, Dick was leaving the store, forcing the male assistant to walk in front of him. A police car stopped. Lieutenant Michener jumped out and ordered him to drop his gun. Instead, Dick pressed it to the head of the assistant and threatened to kill him instantly unless Michener handed over his own pistol. Michener did as he was told. Dick now grabbed Michener as a hostage and ordered him into the patrol car. Michener pointed out that the street was jammed with cars and that it would take half an hour before they could get out. Dick recognised the truth of this and ordered his hostage into Foley's huge department store opposite. Several police followed, but when Dick threatened to kill Michener, the patrolman dropped back. Dick had apparently decided that Michener was likely to be a difficult hostage. The lieutenant was watching for a chance to jump him. Suddenly, Dick thrust him aside and grabbed a young woman, Mrs. Elia Navarez, who was standing behind the wig counter. Michener could see that the gunman was panicking. Dick moved towards the other entrance of the store, dragging the girl with him, his gun against her side. He was obviously hoping to commandeer a car in Main Street. Several police now followed him, and suddenly Dick's nerves seemed to snap. As his finger tightened on the trigger, a detective named Waycott leapt at his gun arm. Dick shot Waycott in the stomach, then turned and deliberately shot Mrs. Navarreth. A bullet fired by a policeman hit Dick in the arm. In the next few seconds, Dick had shot the unarmed Michener in the stomach and hit another policeman in the shoulder and the hand. And then he himself fell to the ground with bullets in both legs and in the back. All Dick's victims recovered. Dick himself received 3 45-year terms for shooting the policeman and another 25-year term for shooting the young woman. He blamed his wife for forcing him to return to crime. The case of Frank Dick is worth considering in such detail because it's typical. 100 similar cases could be cited. The basic motivation for his career of crime was a combination of laziness, aggression, and resentment against society. He became a stick-up man when 5 years of petty crime and jail sentences had brought the resentment to the boil. There was one attempt to retreat from the dead-end career of stick-up man, but instead of giving up crime, Dick merely returned to burglary. The decision to rob Wolfson's, he actually left the store with at least $250,000 worth of loot in his sack, at least showed an intelligent assessment of his situation. That one way to break the vicious circle was with a big job, which would enable him to retire. When it failed, the desperation boiled over. The shooting of Mrs. Navarreth was an act of rage and disgust. We can see very clearly that aggression is a central motivation of a man like Frank Dick. But what causes aggression? In recent years, science has made a remarkable discovery about the root of aggression. It springs from a small nucleus, about the size of an almond, in the temporal lobe of the brain. It's called the amygdaloid nucleus, or amygdala, and its role in aggression has been investigated by Professor Kenneth Moyer of the Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh. Experimenters studied the behaviour of a tyrannical old male monkey, whose behaviour towards his harem of females was notably violent. When his amygdaloid nucleus was removed, the old monkey became docile and good-tempered. Severing of the nerves leading to the nucleus had been shown to be an effective cure for violent psychopaths. Moyer tried the experiment of stimulating the amygdala of a sweet and kindly old lady with electrodes. She turned on the experimenter and screamed abuse at him. When the current was switched off, she apologised, explaining that she knew she had no reason to hate the experimenter, but that the rage had been uncontrollable. Research in this field is still in its early stages, but certain things are already beginning to emerge. Violent aggression can be triggered by brain damage in the area of the amygdala and the hypothalamus. This can be seen clearly in the pathetic case of Lok Ah Tam, a Chinese seaman who went into business in Liverpool in the 1890s and became a rich businessman in a few years. One night in 1918, he got into a fight with a drunken sailor who struck him on the head with a billiard cue, knocking him unconscious. After this, Lok Ah Tam became subject to fits of sudden violence and screaming rages. In 1925, in a fit of fury, he shot his wife and his 2 daughters, killing all 3 of them, and he was hanged in 1926. We should note, however, that Lok Ah Tam's murderous violence was not entirely the result of the brain lesion. There's also the question of habit. The brain is basically a kind of computer, and an important part of its work is to learn habits. The real difference between an adult and a child is not a difference in wisdom or maturity, but simply that the adult consists of layer upon layer of habit, which enables him to handle a wide range of situations with confidence. Anything that deeply affects one's emotions can become a habit. Even quite stupid people can learn to drive a car. Why? Well, because when you're behind the steering wheel, you know that a false move can send you crashing into a wall. The knowledge touches some deep, vital spring, and in no time at all, driving the car has become a matter of habit. The trouble is that any strong emotion can become imprinted in our habit circuits. If someone gives you a bad shock when the radio is playing the national anthem, you'll probably always get a queasy feeling whenever you hear the national anthem. If you happen to be deeply depressed when you're driving along a certain road, the depression will tend to creep back on you whenever you drive along that same road, particularly if it's an unfamiliar road. Though if you drive along it every day, subsequent emotions will gradually erase the earlier impression, just as you can re-record on a magnetic tape. Once a man like Lockhart Tam or Frank Dick has started to develop a certain amygdaloid response, a tendency to fly into rages, to generate a feeling of hatred and resentment towards society, the habit circuits take over, strengthening the response. Moyer concluded that aggression is triggered by certain chemical constituents of the blood, like hormones. But these constituents are produced by glands, and the glands produce more or less hormone as a matter of habit. In other words, Frank Dick is as much an example of conditioning as one of Dr. Pavlov's dogs that salivated at the sound of a bell because it associated it with dinner. The difference is that Pavlov deliberately conditioned his rats and dogs. Frank Dick, like thousands of other violent criminals before him, conditioned himself. How? By launching himself into the vicious circle of robbery with violence. Now, vicious circle here is more than a mere figure of speech. It describes precisely the repetitions that changed Frank Dick from a chicken stealer into a kind of homicidal maniac. Now, the conditioning theory also suggests a possible solution to this particular problem of criminology. In extreme cases, the severing of the brain nerves leading to the amygdala is an obvious possibility. This would have to be done with the prisoner's consent, but if a man like Dick was offered the choice of a life sentence, or a 5-year sentence plus an operation, there can be little doubt which he would choose. However, this need only be considered in extreme cases. An equally interesting possibility is offered by what has become known as abreaction therapy, a type of treatment usually associated with the name of the distinguished psychologist William Sargent. In 1924, the River Neva in Leningrad overflowed its banks, and the water flooded the laboratory of the psychologist Pavlov, forcing his caged rats and dogs to swim for their lives. A lab assistant saved them when some of them had only an inch of air left in their cages. Some of the animals went into emotional collapse, and when they had recovered, Pavlov noticed an interesting thing. All the conditioned reflexes that he had carefully implanted had been wiped out, like chalk off a blackboard. 2 decades later, William Sargent discovered that this worked just as well on soldiers suffering severe mental strain due to battle fatigue and distress. A strong dose of ether was administered, and then the groggy patient was made to relive the experience. He would experience a kind of emotional orgasm, collapse, and then wake up feeling fine. More recently, drugs have been discovered that can wipe the memory tapes without the need for the reliving process. It seems highly probable that such treatment could cure men like Frank Dick, victims of their own amygdala. It certainly seems worth trying.